Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm reading from a brilliant, brilliant new book, Maoism, A Global History by Julia Lovell. If you have an interest in intellectual history and you have an interest in how ideas have shaped the 20th century and how they have morphed and changed and the transitions they go through, this is an absolutely terrific book. And it talks about how Mao's ideas really manifested themselves everywhere from Tanzania to Italy to West Germany to Malaya and beyond. The bit I'm going to talk about is a meeting in 1936 between Mao and the American journalist Edgar Snow. Now, some of you who listen to this podcast regularly might know that one of my particular fascinations is the fellow traveller movement. The men and women mainly in America and Europe in the 30s who viewed the Soviet Union and later Mao's China as being exemplary models of modernity and the means by which the world might break free of the kind of the grasp of the Great Depression or the stagnation of the Great Depression. None of these individuals particularly wanted Maoism or Stalinism in their home countries, but they thought that they were significant. They were achieving significant things in China and the Soviet Union. A strange, slightly kind of inverted colonial attitude, you might argue. Anyway. In chapter 2, The Red Star, Revolution by the Book, Julia Lovell writes, "Late one summer night in 1936, in a cave gouged out of a yellow Loess cliff in northwest China, two men, one Chinese, one American, talked. The American, slim, dark-haired, bearded, was perched on a stool. His Chinese interlocutor, tall, slightly gaunt, with a mop of black hair, lolled jovially over a brick bed, occasionally removing his trousers to cool himself down or pick lice out of his crotch. For the Chinese man, Mao Zedong, a good deal was at stake in getting his self-presentation just so. Aged 44, Mao had only recently gained a position of relative strength in the Chinese Communist Party and was still facing off challenges from rivals with large armies and greater fluency in the Marxist classics. The entire communist state in northwest China was facing imminent extinction by China's official government and the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek. While Chiang limbered up for one last assault to eliminate Mao and his comrades, Chiang's subordinates were building a military blockade around the area. The remnant communists, he confidently told his army that autumn, are now encompassed in a few scattered regions and can be exterminated without much difficulty. At present, communism is no longer a real menace to China. With the military cordon had come a news blackout. No information about the communist movement, independent of nationalist censorship, had broken through for months. The nationalists took advantage of this vacuum to spread rumours that the leadership of had been killed off on a long march from the southeast to northwest China in 1934 to 35. So here we have an opportunity for Mao to transmit his ideas beyond the confines of the area of China that he and his armies already occupied. So when Edgar Snow managed to make it all the way to Yunnan to find Mao and to interview him for the first time, the effort, the payoff was the publication of the book Red Star Over China, which was the first Western account of Maoism and a hugely influential book. If you read The Morbid Age by Richard Overy, which I talk about quite a bit, about the intellectual climate in Britain between the wars, one of the more successful books by Victor Gallant, published by Gallant, was Red Star by Snow, because there was a range of kind of liberal left intellectual voices in Britain and America and Europe during the 1930s that had perhaps little knowledge of Mao, a certain fascination with him, and Snow used the book to present Mao in a very favourable light. Snow was a non-communist. He was generally well disposed to the communist cause, rather in much the same way that John Reed, who was actually far more of a Trotskyite by the end of the Russian Revolution, had reported from the Russian Civil War. Snow hoped this would be a career-making move for him, and he thought that by making it all the way into the communist-held areas, he would be able to present himself favourably to Mao and get an exclusive interview, and it worked. Mao saw in Snow a means to communicate and tried to present the new civilization that the communists were trying to carve out in rural China in as positive a light as possible, in much the same way that the Stalinists presented themselves as being forces of humanity and the future, and they managed to hide the reality of show trials and purges, famines and camps. The Mao was easily able to present a highly misleading picture of the communists to Snow. Everything was carefully controlled, however. Mao had a translator who made sure that Mao understood precisely what Snow was saying and made sure that a correct version, shall we say, a publishable version of Mao's thoughts and ideas were made available to Snow, and that the entire discussion was recorded in a way that was favourable to Mao. Snow completed the English language transcript of the book, and then it was translated back into Chinese for Mao to check and revise, and then translated one last time into English by Mao's translators. So in terms of journalistic integrity, the book was pretty lacking in its kind of overall final execution. It would be considered highly unusual for any journalist to present an entire manuscript to be effectively translated and rewritten by the subject. It's not considered bad practice to check a certain number of facts, dates, and that sort of thing. Every one of the 20,000 words that Snow took away with him went through this editing process, and details about the Communist Party preparations for Snow's visit remain under lock and key in the archive of the Central Committee of the Communist Party in Beijing. They are off-limits to virtually everybody except the most trusted servants of the party, but it is clear that there were rigorous preparations. Mao didn't want to leave anything to chance, and he knew that by manipulating Snow and presenting Snow with an attractive vision of Chinese communism, that it would have immense benefits overseas. Now, it's interesting that Mao, after 1949, creates this highly insular, highly cut-off China, which really has one ally, the Soviet Union. But he goes to such lengths before that in order to court Western opinion through Snow and others. And the answer is perhaps that he was aware that the fate of China and the fate of his revolution would be decided to some extent beyond China's borders. It would be decided by Europeans, or perhaps even by American involvement. And the reason he thought that is because, obviously, the last century of Chinese history had been determined in London and Paris and Washington, and to a growing degree in Tokyo. We do know, however, that Mao gave four instructions to his underlings on how to treat Snow with security, secrecy, warmth, and the red carpet. The efforts produce, obviously, the book Red Star Over China, which portrayed Mao and his comrades as idealist patriots, egalitarian democrats. They portrayed the communist revolution in China as being an entirely progressive affair. The journalism of people like Edgar Snow isn't the sole reason for Western sympathies towards Mao, or in other cases towards Stalin, but it is a significant factor. Without the portrayal of Mao as a man of the people, a down-to-earth public figure who merely has the interests of Chinese democracy and the ability to moderate and to be magnanimous in victory in mind, without those sorts of values being presented as being quintessentially true about Mao, a great deal of the later sympathies for the Maoist regime might not have been there. But as it is, we know that they are, that in Western society there are significant numbers of particularly liberals and the left fellow traveller movement who look upon Mao and say to themselves, essentially, is this not better than what came before? If you're going to condemn Maoism, if you're going to condemn Mao's revolution, surely this is a step up from the kind of the backwards landlordism previously. Sympathies for Maoist China and the Soviet Union peter out in the mid-1950s, by and large, particularly for the Soviet Union. In some cases, the fellow travellers looked to Mao as the kind of the proxy revolution after the Soviets had kind of disgraced themselves in the eyes of Western socialists.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
In Hungary in 1956. However, overall, there's a kind of a distinct drop-off in the appeal of communism after Hungary. In both China and the Soviet Union, during the Second World War, to a greater extent the Soviet Union, because Soviet communists did vastly more of the fighting than Mao's guerrillas did. But in both countries, there was some claim to the kind of anti-fascist pedigree, some kind of claim to anti-fascist legitimacy, which managed to kind of project or propel sympathies towards communism and Maoism into the 1950s. But again, it is the experience of Hungary in 1956 that discredits Soviet communism, and later on events such as particularly it's the Cultural Revolution that finally awakens those internationally with sympathies towards Maoist communism, that all is not well in China. Edgar Snow wrote, "Mao's aims were to awaken China's millions to a belief in human rights, to combat the timidity, passiveness, and static faiths of Taoism and Confucianism, to educate, to persuade them to fight for a life of justice, equality, freedom, and human dignity." It was an enormous bestseller. It sold 100,000 copies in Britain alone in a matter of weeks, and it gained excellent reviews. America's most influential Sinophile, Pearl Buck, wrote at the time that it was intensely readable, extraordinary, and every page of it significant. And John Fairbank, who was the kind of the great 20th century historian of China, who I think died at a kind of very ripe old age in his 90s, wrote that the book was an event in modern Chinese history. And Snow himself became an authority on Chinese politics. He was consulted by Roosevelt, who was trying during World War II to work out what the China policy should be. And the State Department, which made the book basically required reading, contained one official who was so thrilled by the book was he that he, during the Chinese Civil War, leaked Chiang's battle plans to communist sympathisers, who promptly relayed those back to Mao. But the effect in China was significant as well. The book was translated into Chinese, and it convinced large numbers of young, educated Chinese liberals and patriots, those who were not part of the kind of core constituency of Mao, to give up their comfortable and well-heeled lives in the nationalist-dominated cities of coastal China and to march inland, to trek as far as possible towards the northwest to serve Mao's revolution. So Mao's revolution gained an entire generation of kind of educated and skilled young people willing to work and fight and die for it. And this created the kind of part of the tier of the administrator class who would take over in 1949. The book's Chinese translator and editor, a brilliant linguist called Hu Yuzhi, was given the role of being an undercover communist agent in Southeast Asia during the war. The book was then taken with him and read by the future leaders of the Malaysian Communist Party, who would rise up and fight British colonial rule after the end of the Second World War. The Malayan Emergency, which lasted for 12 years, which claimed the lives of 8,000 Malayan and British soldiers and Malay Chinese, was also a period of time in which the book was read thousands of times over in communist training camps up and down Malaya. The book became a kind of a handbook for anti-Nazi partisans in wartime Russia, because Snow had written down in it the Chinese guerrilla warfare tactics, the anti-Japanese guerrillas, the Hook guerrillas in the Philippines, and anti-British revolutionaries in India during the Quit India campaign of 1942. You saw the book as an indispensable guide to fighting insurgency warfare. Mao's friendship with Snow, which he used fairly shamelessly when it suited him, for sort of international propaganda and publicity, all the way up to Snow's death many years later, and became the first example of an international kind of approach that Mao took to his political vision. So Snow's book translated Mao's ideas not just to a Western audience, but to many potentially anti-Western audiences, to people who'd been colonised by Western countries and were seeking to fight them, and to other groups seeking to fight imperialism. But it also placed the concept, the ideas, the arguments of Maoism in an international context, the idea that now there was a different approach to communism than that which was set out in narrow terms by Stalin. So, Julie Lovell writes, Edgar Snow is the first main character in this global history of Maoism, because without him, both a domestic and an international cult of Mao would be hard to imagine. It's difficult to overestimate the influence across space and time of Red Star Over China. Acclaimed as one of the greatest American journalistic accounts of the 20th century, it created a figurehead to humanise the Chinese communist movement, and a constellation of principles and loyalists around him. Snow's starring role in fashioning Maoism highlights from its very beginning the border-crossing quality of a doctrine that is often seen as the most Chinese and most rural of political religions. Snow illuminates the international PR genius of the Communist Party from its early days, and the way Mao's ideas and persona traversed territories, languages and classes, and attracted international cheerleaders. Snow's part in this process also foreshadows the way in which Mao and his lieutenants built and manipulated international networks of support from the 1930s to the present day, networks that changed the course of China's civil war and Cold War and influenced Mao's own political thought and practice. There's a kind of interesting postscript to this story that's brought to us by Frank Dakota in The Cultural Revolution, A People's History. He writes, in January 1965, Edgar Snow was invited to share a meal with Mao Zedong in one of the spacious rooms of the Great Hall of the People. The two went back to 1936, when Snow, a young idealistic reporter from Missouri, had been one of the first foreigners to reach Yunnan. Mao told him his story, and Snow accepted it eagerly. Red Star Over China, published a year later, was the scoop of the century, introducing the chairman to the rest of the world and swaying opinion in favour of the communists, portrayed as agrarian reformers who lived cheek by jowl with the peasants in a great unfolding democracy. Now the chairman was using Snow to convey another message to the outside world, this time on Vietnam. No troops would cross the border as long as the United States did not attack China. The interview was never published in China, but read avidly with those by those with access to it. So, many years later, Mao, unsure about America's intentions in Vietnam, with long memories of the Korean War, and highly suspicious about an American front opening up on his southern border, used Snow in order to send a message to President Lyndon Johnson and the American foreign policy community about the intentions of the Maoist regime. It was not a journalistic scoop for Snow. It was a way of telling America a story in the only way that Mao knew how, through his old friend. Snow's final use for Mao came towards the end of the Cultural Revolution. In the early 1970s, in 1971, when Mao wanted to present to the United States the possibility of a more friendly relationship, Mao having realised that with the combination of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, he had economically and socially devastated his own country and knew needed transferences of technology and later possibly even access to world markets in order to revive the country. He once again called on Snow to be photographed alongside Mao as attempts to court Nixon's administration began. Nixon, of course, via his kind of conciliary Henry Kissinger, was almost too happy to find ways to communicate with China, knowing that this would be the way in which the nightmare of Vietnam could come to an end, and also that detente in the Cold War might be achieved. And so throughout Edgar Snow's life and his relationship with Mao, Mao was able to use him as a kind of a means of communicating with the outside world, at times presenting fantastical and misleading interpretations of Maoist communism, and at other times trying to open the door to the West that had been resoundingly slammed in 1949, and presenting a means of the West deciphering Chinese intentions, which are at the best of times confusing and opaque, often to Western onlookers. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this and found it useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks, all the best, bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.